This is Chasing Encounters, a podcast about stories, languages, cultures, and identities. We highlight diversity and intersectionality in contemporary society through respectful and thought-provoking conversations. Welcome, everybody. This is Chasing Encounters. We have a new episode today. We have Farah, right?
Yes. Thank you so much for having me.
So to start our podcast today, we would like to know a little bit about yourself, who you are, friends, relatives, families, what is what you do, something very informal about you that...
I'd say the last few years I've worked in international development. Most of my work has been geared towards high school students and building programs that help bridge gaps in English, math, and science, predominantly in Central Asia, mostly in the Kyrgyz Republic and Tajikistan. And currently, I work as a education project manager for vocational training with Seneca College in countries like Indonesia and Egypt. And I am a first-year MA student with the CTL department. And I guess one thing people don't know about me is that I used to work in fashion. And I think when you meet me, because I just walk around wearing a sweatshirt and sweatpants, most people don't know that about me. But prior to my lovely shift to international development work, I worked in fashion for quite some time.
Why did you quit fashion?
I think fashion is a lot of fun when you're young. It's very shiny and very quick, and it gives you thick skin, I think, especially the companies that I worked for. But eventually, I think you want a little bit more purpose out of your day. And for me, fashion was not fulfilling that part of my soul, but working with youth was. And once the opportunity came to work in Central Asia, that kind of set the platform for me to want to continue working with youth and working with teachers and seeing what we can do to give them more autonomy and provide them more space to understand the context in which they're working.
Do you speak any other languages besides English?
I do. I speak Kachi, which is a dialect of Gujarati. A very small town in India, I think, still speaks Kachi. I believe the city is called Kutch. And sign language.
Like American Sign Language,
yes.
I'm
assuming.
Yes. Do you use it?
Not often? As much as I used to when I was younger. I had a friend of mine whose both his parents are deaf. We used to hang out quite a bit, so I would use it quite frequently, almost daily. But since they moved to the U.S. about 10 years ago, I very rarely use it now.
Why did you decide to learn the ASL?
ASL, yeah. ASL. My parents, for elementary school, middle school, and high school, my parents sent us to schools that all had programs for children with exceptionalities. Mm-hmm. And I loved it because it allowed us to, I think, grow being more empathy for different types of learners and different types of beings, number one. And number two, because we had that program, we had a lot of students that were deaf. And so sign language was offered as an extracurricular. So I took it from JK to grade 9.
Are you fluent?
I wouldn't say anymore. Once upon a time I was.
Is there such thing as fluency in ASL?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Just like any other language.
Well, good to know. Yeah. I don't know much. That's why I always ask these questions to people, because my questions are always based on how ignorant I am about so many things. So now I have learned.
But it's good. You're very good at being accountable. You know and you ask, which is great.
Exactly. So let's move on really quick about your experience and the reasons why you're working or you have worked in Central Asia.
Sure.
So you said that you've been working in Central Asia. How long have you been working there?
So I worked in Central Asia for about 4 years overall. I lived there for 8 or 9 months cumulatively and was consulting here remotely. I worked for the University of Central Asia, which is a tri-state university. Its first campus was built in the Kyrgyz Republic. They just opened one in Tajikistan 2 years ago, and the one opening in Kazakhstan, I believe, will be next summer. And I was brought on before the actual bricks and mortars campus was opened in the Kyrgyz Republic to help build an academic upgrading program for kids in the region. So that is Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan, mostly those four. So I came in and I worked with local teachers and foreign teachers, as well as local and foreign counselors, to build a 3-week intensive upgrading program in English, math, and science. And that was so that when students wanted to apply for schools in the region, they would have or would get a stronger grade in both of those language areas, because our program was built to be kind of a preparatory base for them. And gave them skills in grammar and phonetics and rephrasing and that kind of stuff. It was an English immersive program, and the goal of that was to encourage them to be more confident in speaking in for them, English would be a fifth or sixth language. Like, a lot of our students could speak, I'd say, at minimum four languages. And the reason for that is because some of the top schools in the region were either English immersive or you had to have a higher grade in English than most of the other schools. So that was kind of the foundation of that. But we were also battling, I would say, at that time, and I'm sure now, because it's only been 5 years since we began that program, a lot of national identity struggles and national identity politics in the classroom, because there's such a strong sense of nationalism with our students. That was something that we noticed was very difficult to break. A lot of our Tajik kids only hung out with other people that were from Tajikistan, Kyrgyz kids, Kazakh kids. And I know for some here, and they're like, yeah, that's standard. If you go somewhere new, of course, you kind of gravitate to people that look more like you and sound more like you. But after 3 weeks, there were some groups were a lot harder to break than others. And I think a big part of it was identity and being able to stick with people that sounded like them and being able to speak in languages that some of the other kids couldn't. And that was, I think, for myself, a very big eye-opener, because I've only worked with children here and English is their first language. Mm-hmm. But working with students where English is their fifth was a big surprise even for myself, because you have to create space for them to say what they need to say and empower them to tell you about how they're feeling, and also build trust with them, especially for someone like me. I don't look Central Asian. I don't speak any of the languages. I'm a woman. I was 24 when I first met. So there was a lot of variables I think were against me. So building that trust was a bit more difficult. Mm-hmm. But that work really set the foundation of why I came to OISE to pursue my MA.
So you were mentioning that the work that you do was in immersion, English immersion. So does that mean that it's 100% in English? People would have to speak 100% in English?
We would encourage to speak in as much English as possible. If there was, like, if they were feeling very down, or if they were sick and they were only able to articulate in Russian, then of course that was allowed, because we had Russian doctors and stuff on site, mm-hmm. in case that was needed. But for us, yeah, we tried to encourage English as much as we could. And a lot of our students came from different English-speaking levels. So kids that came from more rural cities in Tajikistan or Kyrgyz Republic were not speaking English as confidently or as fluently as students that came from some of the major cities like Dushanbe or Bishkek. So we had that variable as well.
So how would you encourage your students to speak English? Give us a couple of examples. So how would you encourage them, especially those who are not necessarily eager to speak?
Sure. The big thing for us was working with the students to define how they saw inclusion. So what to them was the way that they not just defined inclusion, but what did it look like? And so we said, because there was 50% of us in terms of administrators and teachers and counselors were foreign. We didn't speak English or Shugni or Dari or Russian. I mean, we did speak English, but not the other languages that I mentioned. And so we said English is the thread that binds us together in this regard. So we can make space for it. But in reverse, to know that ourselves as administrators and foreign teachers and foreign counselors that don't speak the language, we're also going to do our best to learn Russian or learn another language that is a bit more inclusive, so that when you come to us and you're struggling with something and you can't explain it in English, we can also try to bridge that gap and create space so that you feel completely supported as a student within this particular program.
How would you welcome students, others' linguistic and cultural backgrounds?
Well, we would always do an introduction that was counselor run, and that's because the counselors they're always kind of the first point of contact with the students. I myself as director didn't have as much time with the students, unfortunately, as our team did, but the welcome was always in. We did our best to do an English welcome, a Russian, Shugni, Dari, and we would do our best to incorporate music from different regions. Like in our first year, we had like a dance party for them. We got cookies and treats, and we found a whole bunch of music that was Tajik and Afghani and Kyrgyz, and we worked mm-hmm. with local teachers to find that music to make them feel like this is not purely an English experience. Yes, the goal is to help you feel more confident in your English speaking ability and, of course, to upgrade your skills academically in English, math, and science. But in my heart, at least, it was very much a way for the community to come together and say, we're really not all that different. Our goal here is an academic goal, but here's a way that we can share some of these things that we have in common. And music and film and poetry is a really big thread, I think, in Central Asia. And we did our best to try to incorporate that wherever we could, whether it was through meals or while the kids were playing sports or in evening programs. Just so that, because I would imagine if I went somewhere and I didn't speak that language and everything is in that language, mm-hmm. I myself would be overwhelmed and intimidated, and it's daunting. And so for me, I thought I was 24, and if I felt that way, imagine being 16 and feeling that way, and you're away from your parents. And this was the first 3-week intensive overnight program that I think the region had ever had. I don't think anyone in Central Asia, from my understanding then, had ever built a 3-week overnight math English camp. So in addition to not sleeping in your bed every night, in addition to not seeing your parents or being part of your community, for some being in a completely different country, because we held our program in Kyrgyzstan, but we had kids come from Tajikistan and Kazakhstan. For me, it was all about building trust, bridging gaps, but also supporting them so that when they did go back to their own communities, they felt empowered to share what they learned at that program beyond academia. And for me, that was very much the community development piece.
I want to back up a little bit in a question, because you were mentioning Central Asia. Mm-hmm. And like I said, my questions are based on, like, I don't know. Mm-hmm. And the reason why people like you are in this program is because you're experts in your area, and then you're going to help me and others to understand a little bit better what's going on out in the world. So my question is Central Asia. So I thought Central Asia was just like a little blob of something there in Central Asia.
Sure.
But then now I'm looking at the map and it's like a few countries. So it's not one country, but a group of countries.
Group. It's mostly five. So it's the Kyrgyz Republic, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Afghanistan.
Okay. Did you say Turkmenistan?
I did not. But that, yes, Turkmenistan, I believe. Yes, I apologize. Six countries.
How about Azerbaijan?
Azerbaijan? I don't think so.
Okay.
But I could be wrong.
No, I don't know. No, it's not that you're wrong. I'm just looking at the map, what the map is telling me. So, okay, now that I'm looking at the map, it's because I'm a visual person, so I understand when I see things. So where in one of these countries was your work?
So my work was mostly based out of Kyrgyzstan.
Okay, yes. I'm looking at Kyrgyzstan right now. Okay, yes. What city?
Bishkek, which is the capital.
Okay, now I see Bishkek. Okay.
And we went to Sinigori, which is this little, like, lake between mountains, I believe, in the north of Kyrgyzstan, right at the Kazakh border.
Okay.
That's where we held the programs that I was there for, 2014, 2015, we held it in that region.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I left, because the universities had opened, I believe now the summer programs happen on the campuses of the school. So one program in Narin and one in Koro, which is in Tajikistan.
And these were universities, right?
Or these colleges are universities. Universities.
Okay, so this is higher education.
Yes.
So the population is like, what, like late teens, early 20s?
For the university, great. So in Central Asia, let me backtrack, I apologize. In Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, because it may be different in some of the other countries mentioned, they only go up to grade 11. So once they're 16, they're applying for school. So I'd say by 17, 18, they're in their first year of university.
Right. Right. And what are the languages that they speak? I know you mentioned that there are five languages. Like, let's just give an example. The people in Bishkek.
Sure.
What languages would be happening in the streets, in the schools?
Yeah.
You know, what do you hear?
I say mostly, so Russian for sure is a thread, because these are all post-communist countries.
Mm-hmm.
But as I mentioned, because there's a stronger tie now for national identity, because they're all very young in terms of independence. And Kyrgyzstan, Kyrgyz would be predominantly spoken. I think in some cities that are really trying to get away from the Russian influence, you'll hear a lot more Kyrgyz than you will Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But from my understanding, Russian is still very much the business language.
Got it.
So if you're in the market, you still hear Russian. If you're in business meetings, you still hear Russian over hearing Kyrgyz or Tajik or whatever.
So would you say most of the people are bilingual, Kyrgyz and Russian?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And do you speak some of that, the Kyrgyz, Russian?
I speak a few things in Russian from when I was there, a few phrases that I had picked up. I tried Kyrgyz and Tajik. For me, they were very difficult, but I tried as much as I could. And when I was in Tajikistan for about a week and a half, I picked up a little bit of Shugni because it's very similar to Farsi. And Tajikistan has a very strong Iranian population or Iranian influence or people that had migrated there earlier on. So a lot of people in the north, like in Khorog, which is where I was, they will speak Tajik and Russian for sure, but they will also speak Farsi and Shugni. And if they're closer to the Afghan border, then perhaps Dari as well.
No, one of the reasons why I'm asking you this question, and I usually ask this question to everybody who comes here, because little by little, I've been learning that the world is more multilingual or plurilingual than I thought before, or that we perceive out there. A lot of people think that is in different countries, they speak their home language and English.
Yes.
But we know now, and we have been learning that people speak many languages. I mean, not only two languages. Actually, a lot of people, even in Canada or the United States, you know, they speak only two or three languages, whereas we see, you mentioned earlier,
four or five
languages. So we need to learn that there's no binaries, English and another language. But there are many languages, and that's why my interest lies on. But let's go back to your work. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something really interesting that I liked, the idea of upgrading your skills.
Yes.
So one of the part of the job was upgrading the students' English skills.
Math and science, yeah.
In math and science.
English and in math and in science. So all three subjects.
Yes, but in math in English or math in the home language?
Yes, no, math in English and science in English.
Okay, so math, science, and English, like art, something like that.
Yes,
in English.
Yes.
Okay, so that was the goal. But do you think there is an ultimate goal of upgrading their skills? Is there a goal beyond that, just upgrading the skills? What is the real purpose for them? Let's say, and I'm just tossing this out, get ready for the labor market in the West?
So I would actually say getting ready for the labor market where they live. And I'll say it from... So from my time in working with the University of Central Asia specifically, they had, for each of the three campuses in the three countries, they each had a core subject area that correlated with the major economic demand.
Okay.
So for example, in Tajikistan, earth and environmental sciences, because they are very much a mountain region, is one of the core subject areas that was offered by, or is offered by, the University of Central Asia. And it's because through whatever data they've analyzed, they noticed that in Tajikistan in the next 5 to 10, 20 years, this is going to be a big pocket where labor will be required, but there's not enough skills in that area. And so that's how they've done it. And I think the second one is marketing, if I'm not mistaken. And then Bishkek, which is in Kyrgyzstan, has two specializations. And Kazakhstan, which will open next year, has two specializations. I think computer science and engineering is one of them. And I don't know what the second one is. But that's how the curriculum in terms of the core subject areas was built. So yes, I would say there is a higher goal of being able to be skilled at a better quality school, so to speak, but to use those skills domestically.
Yes, you got me thinking, because if the target is the local labor, why not doing it in the local language, right? And improving that language skills and that labor skills.
Yeah.
Rather than English. To me, not necessarily you mentioned this, but for me, the way I see it is it looks like we want to become similar to those in the West, or sort of to export this knowledge or these skills to the West, somehow be compared to international standards. Maybe I've seen it in Latin America and in other countries that they want their students to learn English because they want to, you know, be equal to the international standards in Europe or North America, but it seems like this is not the case.
No, I mean, there could be a hidden agenda of that maybe I was not privy to be a part of that conversation. It's also important to note that, and I apologize because I should have mentioned this sooner, the University of Central Asia is a subsidiary of the Aga Khan Development Network. So the Aga Khan Development Network, which we'll just say is the AKDN, is a massive nonprofit network, and it's got a lot of reach and a lot of branches in different subject areas. So they have Aga Khan Education Services, they have Trust for Culture, they have architecture, they have music. So there's a whole bunch of different things, health, social welfare, a whole bunch of things. So the University of Central Asia falls within the AKDN. Now, my assumption is that the AKDN, of course, has its own mandate And so English speaking might have come from some of the powers that be. And again, I was not privy to be part of those conversations. But I would assume that English maybe to be able to have more economic conversations with people in North America and Europe, because that is the predominant business language on this side of the pond. Mm-hmm. But I agree. And interestingly enough, I had gone to a seminar last week with Dr. Carol Benson from Colombia, and she had spoken about L1 languages, about how a lot of nonprofits and organizations will go in. And traditionally, we don't teach students in their dominant language, which is interesting, because if you want to train them to be part of their local markets, and that's what the local language is, why integrate something like English as an example, mm-hmm. if that is not even a minority language? And she was speaking about Cambodia and Senegal, but they're very similar to Central Asia in the sense that it's very similar economic demands, number one. Number two, there is still a lot of rural communities that and a lot of people that live in mountains or forest areas that don't have access to what might be available in some urban cities. And number three, you know, being able to encourage and empower local teachers to be able to do that for their students, as opposed to relying on foreign aid to do that for you. So I agree with what you're saying, that why not do it in the local language? Doesn't have to be Russian. If they want to get away from that, we could have done it in Kyrgyz, Tajik, or Kazakh. But it's a good question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, no, and the answer to this question does not have to be answered by you necessarily. But we always pose these questions to people out there to,
of course,
as food for thought, right? Like, what is the real agenda for so many organizations, NGOs, corporations, etc., to bring this to the table, right? Yeah. And then I don't have the answer, but we want to ask ourselves, where is this coming from, right? So I'm going to follow up on another thing that you said earlier, the idea of immersion, right? And this is immersion schools. And who gets to go to these immersion schools? Who are the people who go there? It's like lower class, middle class, upper class.
Yeah. So do you mean the university itself or yes. the program that I...
Well,
that
we both, had, the university both. Sure. and the program.
So we used a similar admissions process, I guess, for both. So because our summer camp also kind of mirrored what the university experience would be, right? It's, hey, if you come to UCA, you're going to get 6 to 8 hours of very intensive academic programming. You're also going to get sports and evening programs and community development and soft skills and all that kind of stuff. But right. So the criteria was that the students had to actually write an exam in English and math. And then based on a certain score, we brought in those students. Of course, part of it was the top scoring kids came into our programs in that. But we did our best to say 20% have to come from each of the founding countries. So Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, that's 60%. 20% have to be students that come from rural or mountain regions. And 20% have to be girls.
Okay, that's kind of like a good deciding thing
factor. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was good in the sense that we had a really good mix up of academic proficiency in English, math, and science. It was, I'm sure, challenging for the teachers, because even we did level our students, but even in your lowest level, so people that were not performing as strongly in math, so let's say level 4, you'd have someone that has a 22 and someone who has a 60. So even that gap is still quite big. It's a 38% gap in your lowest level alone. Right. And data has shown us that your lowest performing kids, unfortunately, do not get as much out of upgrading programs as much as your middle performing kids do, because they have a little bit more leeway to grow. Mm. And your highest performing kids often don't get that much, because they've, if not plateau, there's not too much higher that they can go. So for us, we use that criteria to get our students for the programs.
The reason why I ask you this question about who's getting into this school is because for what I've seen from different context that I have explored, it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, and if I'm wrong, it's okay to be wrong as well. Mm-hmm. Usually those who get into this type of schools in other contexts, the top scores, as you mentioned, like people have to like pass an entry exam, and then obviously you admit those top scores. I have seen that most of them are usually in the middle upper class.
Yes.
Because they have obviously got better, quote unquote, better education through life, because private education or their parents have more money to send them abroad, you name it.
Yeah.
And then I'm always aware that people who are left out of these decisions are those who are at the margins.
Mm.
I don't know if this is the case.
So for us, definitely not. Of course, we did have some kids. Most of the kids that came from either big cities or Kazakhstan specifically, because there's a lot of oil there.
Right.
They were definitely more socioeconomically able to come. But as I mentioned, we had a lot of girls and a lot of kids that came from rural regions. So like Khorog as an example, which is literally a 12-hour drive weaving through mountains from the capital city in Dushanbe in the north, very close to the literally 25 kilometers to the Afghan border. So that community is very marginalized. There's very little access for them. Right. A lot of people don't put infrastructure in Khorog because how are you going to get there? But our program, as I mentioned, like 1/5 of our kids had to come from cities that looked like that, that had very little access, where there wasn't a presence of American schools or Canadian schools or embassies running after school English programs. So that was the great thing about our program, that I think it allowed specifically those marginalized students to have a chance. And I remember we had this one girl who came from a very rural city in Kyrgyzstan, and she was a daughter of a farmer, and he was also the religious leader of his community. And we had to beg him to send his daughter to the... She got in meritocratically. She scored high. Wow. We wanted her to come. And he's like, he had said, you know, I don't believe in education, let alone that my daughter should be educated. Wow. Just speaking to some of the mentalities that exist. Not to say that those mentalities don't exist here, but he was very honest about why he didn't want his daughter to come. But meritocratically, she could come and we had funding for her. So she was able to come to our program. And now she's at the University of Central Asia and is doing very, very well there. I think she's graduating next year. So our program, I think we did our best to try to get those kids to break out of that cycle and to say, you, not to disobey your parents, but to say, if you meritocratically, like, what can you say to someone when you said, I am a top scorer, I've meritocratically earned it, and the school sees my value and is willing to pay 95% of my tuition? Why would I say no?
Yes.
And so we were very lucky in that I think we were able to assist children like her. How many, I don't know. I don't have that data, but she sticks out to me as someone that I've remembered since I left in 2015, that we were able to help her and girls like her.
What was the father's rationale for not allowing her daughter to go to quote-unquote regular school?
I think from my understanding, because I wasn't involved in the conversations because I don't speak Kyrgyz, but my conversations with her when she was at the program was, I think the culture in that specific community didn't really encourage females to be educated. And there was a lot of, like, a lot of girls were married off by 15 or 16 years old. And so I think there was just a generational gap in thinking. She very much wanted to break this cycle. He belonged to a different time of thinking, different way of thinking. And so I think from what I gather, that's where that comes from.
So these programs are paid by the government or are paid by the parents? Who's paying the cost for these programs?
So the cost is split. So for our summer camp, it wasn't subsidized by the government. But if you go to the university, there is some subsidies and loans offered by, it's a partnership of like half university will give, half the government will give as like a loan structure. And then the kids have, I think, 5 or 10 years to pay the loan back to the government. So that there's not too much reliance on private donorship and that kind of stuff. But of course, if parents can afford it, then that meant we could allocate our funds to kids who maybe couldn't afford it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, now we're moving on to your research.
Sure.
How do you connect all of these vast experience to your intended research here at the University of Toronto?
Yeah. So my research question right now is looking at how local and foreign teachers worked together in a context like UCA. Mm-hmm. So my goal is to interview teachers that taught in English and math at the program that I developed, because I kind of know the ins and out of that, and to say, what was your experience as a local teacher? What was your experience as a foreign teacher? What did you learn from each other? Because I would imagine that as an educator coming in, you're still a forever teacher because your students are really the ones that are guiding your classroom dynamics, in my opinion. So I want to see what they learned. I want to have an honest conversation about what some of the challenges were, because I've noticed in working in international development work, especially with higher ed and high school kids, there is a lot of tension between foreign expertise and local expertise. And I think part of that is foreigners do not do a good job, whether it's systemically or individually, right, to integrate local people's voices and context. Mm-hmm. And I think local people are maybe very used to other organizations coming in and stepping all over their domain, that there is perhaps an exhaustion around the willingness to have those conversations. And so my goal is to say, if you were, like I said, a foreign teacher, what were the challenges? Because you were dealing with kids who English was not their first language, but it was your first language as the educator. Number two, you're dealing with a lot of political national identity stuff, which may not be the case if you're working in Ontario, let's say. So how are you navigating that? Right. Number three, you had students, as I mentioned, if you were in level four, one kid was at 32, one kid's at 60. Mm. How are you mitigating, right, or helping to curate your pedagogy and your curriculum to meet the needs of your students? Mm. And for me, I'm interested to see what both sides of the coin have to say, because I think very often nonprofits or higher education institutions go to these places in the world and either don't have time or the ability, whether it be language or capacity, to have those conversations. And I think there is also some fear and exhaustion from locals to want to have that conversation. So my goal is for those of us that have lived in Canada, like myself, and want to continue doing international work, how do you integrate the grassroots? Because you can't know who you're serving if you don't have the conversation. So that the goal of my research is to look at that, but through the teacher experience.
Right. So obviously you will not be interviewing students or parents, no, just the teachers.
Just the teachers.
And will you be doing classroom observations?
I would like to. I would like to go back and do some classroom observations for sure. I do have the data from when I went in 2014 and 2015 of my own experiences. So it would be nice to see 4 years later what's happening and how the program has changed, especially because now there's less reliance on foreigners. Right. They now have local teachers that do English, math, and science at the camp. There's no need for us to have volunteer teachers come in from Europe or Canada or the US. So it'd be interesting to see how the classroom dynamics have changed.
So what are you looking forward to seeing when you go there?
The kids, for sure, number one. Mm-hmm. To see how they are thriving and how they are reflecting and how they are challenging things that are not working for them and how they are having those conversations and how they are battling stereotypes and stigmas in that part of the world. I think it is an area of the world, based on the literature review that I have done, that people know very little about, let alone teacher practices. I think for me, because I have Sof Rose as a supervisor, and he is Tajik, and he doesn't only have the academic lens of teacher training through his own thesis work, but also has the reality of I've lived here and breathed here, and I know what's not romanticized and what is. Okay. So I'm excited to see from their lens the non-romanticized version of what's happening, and then being able to talk to teachers and say, hey, what are we doing to help make this a more holistic experience for not just our students, but for ourselves? Because I think if there's not camaraderie between teachers, it's very difficult for you to root for your students and to give them what they need, in my experience of what I've seen.
Yeah, I think I like what you're saying. It's very exciting, fascinating story. I wonder, before we finish today, is sure. there anything that you wanted to add that you haven't said or you wanted to say about yourself, your life, your work, your experience, or the work that you intend to do in Central Asia?
Just a very, very big thank you to the powers that be and to the people that have come in my path. I've been very lucky to get some really fantastic mentors, and I have a very supportive family, and just great people here at OISE as well that create space for this to happen. And a big thank you to you as well, because this is the first time I think I've talked about the work that I want to do with anybody that's not Sof Rose. So it's nice to have that space and to also learn more about your background, because I think that there's so much that's happening yes. around the world that people are unaware of. But it's nice to meet other people that have passion and they're nurturing what their soul's desires and what their soul's work is. So thank you for creating space for that.
Thank you for coming. My name is Yacido Ortega, and this is Chasing Encounters. Have a great rest of the week, everybody.
I am a dog person because I like that they come and cuddle with you. Cats will only come when they really want to.